taxes. Another draw.
Let's be sure to build. Put something else. Let's put something else on the building for tomorrow. Okay, that's really bad.
Fintech.
There you go. And of course, that explains why Mr. Romaine is with us today. All right. Good morning, Dick. Have you been before this committee yet?
No.
Okay. Well, for new members, this is Dick Yates, our staff economist who deals with excise, timber, transportation.
Lottery.
And lottery. Yeah. Okay.
All of Finland.
Go ahead.
Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. In addition to the material I'm going to go through today, again, I would encourage you to look at the public finance basic facts documents that we recently published. There are sections there on excise taxes, which cover some of the taxes here, also on motor fuel taxes and on the other aspects, but basically the excise taxes that I'm going to cover today. In addition, we did put out a research brief, or a research report brief, actually, on the Master Settlement Agreement, which you might want to look at. Excise taxes, in general, taxes and fees, we sort of distinguish between taxes and fees, where a tax, the purpose of a tax is to raise revenue for general government purposes, where fees in general are charges for services. Excise taxes differ from income and sales taxes basically in how the base of the tax is defined. All of taxes involve some sort of a rate. An income tax is a rate which applies to a definition of income, taxable income under Oregon law. Sales taxes, to the extent that they exist, are generally on the value of the product sold. And excise taxes tend to be per unit. So they're measured based on the number of units. For example, with tobacco taxes, cigarettes are per cigarette, essentially. We usually talk about the rate in terms of per pack of 20, but in the law it's actually levied per cigarette sold. Other tobacco products differ a little bit because they're, the tax base for other tobacco products is the wholesale price. And so it's more like a sales tax, but we still are calling those taxes excise taxes. Alcoholic beverages, again, are per unit. They're based on the gallons or barrels of beer that are sold. In the telecommunications area, we have the 911 tax. And again, that's based on units which have access to the 911 emergency communications network. And then in the area of fuel taxes, you have gasoline and diesel taxes, which again are based on a gallon sold, not the value of the product. So all of these are treated as excise taxes, and we'll talk about each a little bit today. I've also included in tobacco taxes the Master Settlement Agreement. We'll talk about that specifically, but basically that's almost, you can be viewed as sort of a multi-state excise tax. Where the amount that's paid is apportioned back to the states that are involved. With cigarette taxes, a history of the rate. I go back here to 1967 when it was 4 cents, divided 2 cents to the general fund, 1 cent each to cities and counties. Then a series of increases in 1971 and 82, which involved only the general fund portion, going up from 2 cents to 7, and then to 17. And then in 1986, you get increases, a total increase in the tax to get the right number here, 27 cents. And that's 21 cents going to the state general fund and 3 cents each to cities and counties. The next change was in 1990, and that's kind of an interesting change because the city and county portion went down from 3 to 2 cents, but you had a new distribution to elderly and disabled transportation. So each of those, the state now goes to 22 cents, state general fund, and cities, counties, and transit each get 2 cents. Then in 1994, we have a temporary tax passed to fund the health plan. And that's 10 cents, which enters in here as the blue. Then in 97, you have ballot measure 44, which added another 30 cents. And the 27 cents of the increase under ballot measure 44 went to the Oregon Health Plan, and 3 cents to what I call TURA, the Tobacco Use Reduction Account. And the distributions then to Transit City and County remaining at 2 cents. Then in November of last year, 2002, the 60-cent increase was passed, and that went primarily to the health plan, but there are small increases in the distributions to the other accounts. If you look at how Oregon compares with other states, and you take just the excise tax. Now, some states also impose the sales tax over and above the excise tax. But if we just look at the excise tax itself, the data that I have is for July 1 of 2002. And at that time, Oregon's rate was 68 cents, and that made Oregon 18th in terms of the ranking among the states. We're now at $1.28, which would put us up here in fifth place. But that's one thing that's happening around the states, around the country, is that rates are all changing, so it's a little bit unfair to change Oregon's rate and compare it. What we'll do is we should get out in January from the National Tax Association a listing as of January 1, 2003, and then we can compare Oregon to that. If you add the sales tax, these are based on the price per pack that's sold in each state, and Oregon moves down to about 23rd. However, it would still remain about fifth at $1.28 in the overall distribution. Last year, the revenues from cigarette tax were $155 million. And you can see 32% of that went into the general fund, 55% into the health plan, 4% into the tobacco use reduction account, and then 9% is divided evenly between transit, cities, and counties. The history or the distribution now that we have the 60-cent rate, we have three rates effectively, a permanent 58-cent rate, which is the old 28-cent rate that existed in Oregon prior to ballot measure 44, plus the additional 30 cents under ballot measure 44. Then there's the temporary tax, which was to support the health plan, and then there's the tax that passed last November of 60 cents. These are all distributed differently. From the permanent tax, about 38% goes to the general fund, about 46-47% into the health plan, 5% into the tobacco use, and then 10% is distributed equally among the transit cities and counties. All of the temporary tax goes into the health plan. Most of the new tax goes into the health plan. These two small adjustments here, or additions for the tobacco use reduction and for the local, were intended to compensate those units of government or those funds for the fact that increasing this tax by another 60 cents was going to reduce the amount of cigarettes consumed. We assume that the tax is passed on, the retail price will go up, and that consumers are price sensitive. So as the price goes up with that additional 60 cents, the amount of consumption goes down, and the result is the 58 cents rate will produce less money. And so the effect of increasing the tax would have been to reduce the amount of revenue going to the tobacco use reduction account and to local governments. These rates were intended to hold that constant. So in the end, if you take the total cigarette tax, we've got about 17% now that goes into the general fund, about 75% for the health plan, 2.6 for tobacco use reduction, and 5.3 divided evenly between transit, cities, and counties. Looking forward with the new rate, the higher rate now, what do we expect this to produce in the 2003-2005 biennium? So this is a forecast. The bar on the left is just how much each rate raises. The 58-cent rate is about $220 million, and then the 10 cents temporary tax and the 60 cents that is just passed. Total $493 million that we expect to be raised during the upcoming biennium. About 90 of that will go into the general fund, about $362 million into the health plan, $14 million into the tobacco use reduction, and $28 million to be divided between transit cities and counties. If we look at the sort of compare population growth over this period from 78, I've run this out to the end of the forecast, actually, which is 2009, and compare the expected distribution or actual distributions of taxable cigarettes, you can see that there has been quite a decline, so that per capita consumption, or more accurately, per capita taxable distributions have gone down. And that's a question which has been sort of bothering us the last couple of sessions, and has resulted essentially in the establishment of the Tobacco Task Force to try and investigate whether the difference here is really a reduction in consumption or simply illicit distributions of cigarettes, which don't get counted as taxes. And so you'll see some legislation this time to try and clean up some of the tobacco tax law to facilitate the efforts by the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice to increase compliance, also the state police.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Fox.
Will we be seeing some statistics regarding rates on excise tax on cigarettes in adjacent states? I see a general excise tax comparison, but for instance, does Washington, how much is a pack of cigs in Washington?
I have data from used to be the Tobacco Institute. That's been taken over by a private consultant. And they do provide a sort of average by state of the retail price, including generic brands as well as major brands.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, the major brands dominate the market. And they do have an average price across states, and I can get that data for you.
Great. I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Again, it's, you were talking right now, it's very important when, because, you know, New York State just increased its tax to $1.50 per pack, and if you're in the city of New York, they also have a city tax rate of $1.50, so you're paying $3 a pack in tax. My understanding of some of the reports, at least, that cigarettes are selling for about $7 a pack, that is when the tax is included.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of concern about, you know, people walking around the city of New York with suitcases of cigarettes, which they've gotten, you know, from an Indian reservation or from Georgia or some state that doesn't tax them.
But in Oregon, the illegal trade in cigarettes, I was assuming it would be people driving to Vancouver to buy them. Or
well, there are two. I'd like to think of two different areas where that's involved, and one is simply people that live along the border and can cross over into a low-tax state and buy their cigarettes cheaper, less expensively. And then there's the crime market, where you're dealing with truckloads of product that are moving around. Border states don't necessarily matter too much what their rates are, because you can haul a truckload of cigarettes across the country and make a lot of money if you can avoid the total tax on it. And right now, there's not a lot of difference. Oregon at 128, Washington at 142, there's not a lot of margin there. Idaho is only at 28, but they're talking about increasing that. So there's $1 a pack, $10 a carton difference between Idaho and Oregon. And one might expect some traffic there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Williams.
On the issue of evasion and black market cigarettes, I'm always, and Dick, you may not be the, we might have to get somebody from the Department of Revenue to talk about this issue a little bit, but I'm always interested on how someone legally obtains a semi-truckload of cigarettes to start carting around the country. I mean, how does that work? You know, I don't assume that they just, you know, stop off at 175 7-Elevens over the course of a... they buy in bulk somewhere, either from the manufacturer or from some distributor, which is purchased from the manufacturer, in order to make that transport. Or are they knocking trucks off on the delivery? I mean, how is that happening?
I think, I'm certainly a neophyte in terms of my understanding of that area. I think you do have some organizations which may have wholesale outlets in other states or have control of those, and they can simply sell those to whomever they want. But I think that would be a good question to put before the task force that's essentially getting very deep now into trying to understand within Oregon the extent of smuggling and how it's being done. So they have some ideas, and I'm sure they'd be glad to share those with you.
Are we going to have them come testify at some point, Mr. Chair?
We introduced the bill.
Yeah, we've got a task force bill, so they'll be in to talk to us all about that. Yeah.
Great.
One of the task force bills goes to Ways and Means, but there are other cigarette compliance tax bills that are coming through, and we can have them in. Part of this difference here between population growth or the reduction in per capita consumption is expected. If you look at what's happened to the price of cigarettes, and this is just Oregon, what I've got here in blue is essentially what the consumer price index looks like. And I think this is the national consumer price index, but it looks much the same if you try to use the Portland index. And then in dark blue. In light blue, what I have are the actual cigarette prices that are reported for Oregon. And so you can see a tremendous increase, much faster than the rate of prices generally, in the price of cigarettes. And if consumers are sensitive to price, you would expect a reduction in consumption.
Dick, that's the price. Does it include the tax? Or is
that's the retail price, which would include the tax.
Okay.
So I should have made this axis the vertical axis in currency rather than, because this is $3.50 a pack, which is about where it is now. Only $35 a card. Moving then to the other tobacco products, and what we're talking about now is cigars. It's also pipe tobacco, snuff, chewing tobacco, any other form of tobacco, including, tobacco which is sold essentially for roll your own. This tax initiated in Oregon in 1985, and as I said, the base of the tax is wholesale price. So the wholesaler has some price at which he would sell the product to retailers before tax. He increases that by 35%. And that becomes a tax liability of the wholesaler to be paid to the Department of Revenue. And so the retailer then receives that price, wholesaler price plus tax, and applies whatever retail markup they make to get the retail price. In 1997, again with ballot measure 44, the rate of this tax was increased to 65%. And it's sort of hard to say, but it's not 30%, but 30% of wholesale price goes to the general fund, 27% of wholesale price goes to the health plan, and 3% of wholesale price goes to the tobacco use reduction. The last change here I can't really show in a bar. In the last legislature, 2001, cigars were limited. So cigars are one of the other tobacco products. Cigars are limited to 50 cents each. And what that looks like, basically, is this would be the tax. I've assumed here a retail markup of 20% on other tobacco products. That's a little higher than I use for cigarettes, but I think it's what's fallen out of what research I've done anyway as to what the retail markup is. And if it is, in fact, 20%, then basically a 50-cent cigar is going to result in about a 22-cent tax. Something of that sort. And as you move up here, I think it's by the time you get to $1.06 here, is the point where the limit first takes effect. If the retail price is $1.06, the tax is 50 cents. As you move up to more expensive cigars, for example, at $2 per cigar, the tax would be $1.01. It's limited, however, to 50 cents.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not being a frequent buyer of cigars, I have no concept of how much they cost. Do most cost more than that 50-cent limit? Or
I think I could answer that. I really don't know exactly what sort of the distribution is by price, but I think you could say most cigars, in terms of quantity, are not limited. But if you took most products that pass through, like tobacco confectionery stores, where people are buying, you know, better cigars, if you like, they can be easily five or.
There's an option. You suggest maybe that it gives me an idea, maybe for a field trip.
$5 or $6 a piece for one cigar?
Well, yes. Unless you buy it in a bar and then it's $10.
We can buy it from Dick's connection to that source in Havana that he knows very little about.
What?
Being a neophyte in this area.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While we're on the subject of mysteries that I've lived long enough that I shouldn't ask this question. Dick, can you define what snuff is for me?
It's a tobacco product which is inhaled.
And it is sold in Oregon?
Yes.
Okay. You got some?
No.
You were raking in your
pocket. He's a neophyte in that area, too.
Okay. Inhaled.
I believe that.
This is what Representative Berger learned in her revenue orientation time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Harris.
I think, well, at least the theory was that tax limit to keep some of the premium cigar businesses in Oregon
right.
going because they were getting killed by the mail order and the catalog orders and the internet orders from states where they had little or no.
Right. That's one of the changes you'll see in terms of the request by the Department of Revenue or the AG. I'm not sure which. I'll confuse these bills a little bit. But currently, this tax is on the wholesaler. So if you import over the Internet cigars and the wholesaler does not have nexus in Oregon, neither the wholesaler nor the purchaser owes the tax. There is no tax imposed on that purchase. And the legislation, the proposed legislation, will make it clear that the tax is on individuals. And if it's not paid by the wholesaler, the individual is responsible for the tax.
How would you enforce it?
Well, Big Brother is, you know... It's
like all taxes, we depend on voluntary compliance.
There was an effort, a combined effort by the Alaska Department of Revenue and the U.S. Treasury, tobacco and firearms, where they went in and tried to determine the extent of cigarette consumption over the Internet and also by mail order. And they actually went in and billed people for cigarettes they had purchased and not paid the tax on. So there are ways to do it, and, you know, if you do that a few times in general, the word tends to spread and you get much, much higher voluntary compliance. Anyway, at 65%, the state comparison here is difficult. What I've done is rank those states which have a comparable tax, where the tax is either on the wholesale price or the manufacturer's price. And I can sort of relate the two. What you find at the end here are a number of states where the tax is a true excise tax. If it's a 5-inch cigar, you pay 3 pennies. If it's a 4-inch cigar, you pay 2 pennies. And they've got a whole series of tax rates that apply to the different types of tobacco products. And I have no way to make those comparable to Oregon's rates, so I don't know whether they're higher or lower. But among the states that I can compare, Oregon is number three at 65%. Revenue from the other tobacco products last year, fiscal year ending June 2002, $20.1 million. Most of that going into the general fund, 53%, 42% in the health plan, and 5% into the tobacco use reduction account. Taking all tobacco revenues together, this is sort of a historical graph of the revenues generated. And you can see a little bit the effect of reduced taxable distributions. Oregon's rate here, or the rate going to the general fund, has basically been constant throughout this period at 22 cents. But the revenues going to the general fund have declined, and that's because consumption or taxable distributions have declined. So again, you see a picture of the rates primarily. In the beginning, there's just the general fund and the city counties. Then you get the transit entering in about 1985, and then the health plan beginning with the temporary tax, and then with ballot measure 44 you get the health plan and also the tobacco use reduction account. And you can see the big growth in terms of distribution has been to the health plan. These are the forecast numbers out here for the upcoming biennium. The rest of the numbers to the left are actual.
I think it is instructive, though, that in that the peaks represent the enactment of an increase, and they're both followed, one in history and one in projection, I guess, by declines in revenue.
Correct.
Chair, if I could, the ultimate question is, and this is again something I'm interested to hear the task force testify about, is the decline in revenue based on a reduction in usage, and to the extent that fewer people are actually smoking as a result of that, I don't see that as a bad thing.
Yeah.
The fact that we're capturing the money and putting what people are spending into the health plan as its majority source, and driving fewer people off of the product that causes so much of the expense long term in the health plan, I think isn't a matter of bad public policy. It's only to the extent that we're not actually forcing the usage numbers down and it's falling because people are evading the tax that I think we have to be careful of our relationship as we apply this from sort of a social tax policy. So that's the part that I guess I'm most interested in. And certainly when we went to raise it this last time in the special session, one of the chief arguments in the position was that it was going to create a massive amount of black market, gray market efforts. And I guess I'm interested in hearing how much that actually produced and what we think the impact of that's going to be.
Yeah, and my observation, I think, was not so much a reflecting any judgment on that, is just a more matter of revenue policy. You tend to get a quick high, and then falling off there for whatever reason, just as a matter of as a source of revenue on a long term basis.
Well, wasn't it Chairman Strobeck a few sessions ago who said that our policy is to, we want you all to buy them but not smoke them, right?
Moving to the master settlement agreement, and maybe more appropriately the master tobacco settlement agreement, but it won't fit on one line. What you had in the around 97 was basically all states initiating suits against the major cigarette manufacturers, again because the product is causing health problems. But also these suits involve racketeering and a number of other issues. But the attempt was to recover the costs of treating smoking-related illnesses for antitrust violations, essentially, and for consumer protection, and racketeering were the things that were involved in that suit, a lot of issues. Four states settled separately. 47 states settled as a group, and the Oregon included, and the settlement of those suits is called the Master Settlement Agreement. And in this settlement, those four original participating manufacturers who were parties to the suit, and at that time, in 97, actually controlled 96.4% of the market. So that's why they were, in fact, the defendants in the case. The agreement specified that these cigarette manufacturers would make payments into an escrow account, and that the payments would then be apportioned back to the states, to the 47 states that were members, parties to the suit. Other manufacturers then had a choice. They could become subsequent participating manufacturers, which means that they agree to the terms of this settlement and make similar payments to the original participating members. Or they could be non-participants. Now, some states said, okay, if you're not a participating member, you cannot sell, say, cigarettes in our state. And they've got the problems of enforcing that, however they might do that. What Oregon did essentially was pass, following this agreement, they passed what's called the qualifying statute, wherein we make certain agreements which bring us into compliance with the Master Settlement Agreement or certain statutes. And we also agreed to impose or require that any non-participating manufacturer put payments into escrow, which are basically just like an excise tax for cigarettes that they sell in the state of Oregon. They're required to deposit money into an escrow account. That escrow account then is to be used if there's any legal action related to cigarettes brought against that company by the state. So there's a pot of money out there the state can address if they can prove some basis for a claim against those non-participating manufacturers. That money, a payment goes into that account, say, the first of this year. If the state hasn't tapped it, if it's still there 25 years later, it reverts back to the manufacturer. But the state has a guarantee, at least, that there's an amount of money based on sales by non-participating members that will go into an escrow account, and it's like a bond, in a sense, to guarantee that they'll have money to pay any judgment against them, any future judgment against them. Anyway, the result of the agreement here between the 47 states and the cigarette manufacturers is a series of annual payments in perpetuity, forever, as long as the terms of this agreement are met. However, those payments are actually stated in terms of dollars, billions of dollars that are going to be paid, but they're subject to adjustments. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time today going into those adjustments, but when we get into some legislation related to it, we'll talk about the importance of them. The primary adjustments are an inflation adjustment, which increases the payment, a volume adjustment, which tends to increase it, and another adjustment, which reduces the amount going to the 47 states because of the prior settlements with the four other states that settled separately. Anyway, the payments, what I've done here in terms of the period is to... basically, the data I had was actual payments through June 30th, 2002. And then I, the next year finishes out the current biennium. And then I've simply taken an average here for periods where these payments vary. So this, for example, is the year represents years 2003-04 through 2006-07. Sorry if that's a little confusing. There are three types of payments that are made into the national escrow accounts. An initial payment, which is for 5 years only, and then an annual payment, which goes on in perpetuity. And Oregon gets a share, a fixed share, which is about 1.15% of the total amount that's paid in nationally, or at least paid in for the 47 states. And of the total payments received through 2002, June 30, 2002, Oregon has received $257.6 million. What we expect to receive this fiscal year, 2002-03, is 81.4. We've already got some of that in the bank. In this, the last initial payment came in December. But the main payment will be in April, and that will complete the through the end of the current biennium, and we expect $81 million. Then on average for the next 4 years, we pick up about $70.3 million. Then beginning in 2007-08, there's a strategic payment. And this is another, just under the settlement agreement, another payment that's made to the state. It's made over 10 years, and Oregon expects to receive $19.3 million a year over that period. So the total Oregon will receive jumps up to 95.6. And after that payment ends, basically, the amount of this payment, the only payment will be the annual payment, and that will be affected, as I said, by an inflationary adjustment and a volume adjustment. And the base of that, I'm estimating, starts at about 93.5, and whether it goes up or down depends on those different adjustments. All right, what did we do with the revenue? Well, we had a period there where the 1999 legislature put to the people referendums, essentially, that which would distribute this money, put it into certain funds, and also there was separate initiative petition, and all of those failed. So as a result, no money was appropriated during the 99 legislature, and it just basically sat in bank accounts. Then the 2001 legislature essentially has appropriated the entire amount. There is no dedication, but it was all appropriated, so there's nothing left essentially for this upcoming biennium.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
A quick question regarding the projections of estimated payments and dedications. What occurs to these payments if, by some miracle, you know, 75% of the people who smoke quit smoking?
That's one of the adjustments.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, if 75% of the people in Oregon quit smoking, it might not make much difference.
Uh-huh.
But if in the 47 states that are involved, 75%, you know, your payments would go down. I think I'm
significantly,
yeah, and I think probably very close to proportionally.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Before we move away from cigarettes, the Attorney General held a group together and talked about this a couple of years ago. And there are some other things that are being done to impact the use of cigarettes, and I think that some of it is probably effective. Number one, they're regulating a number of ads that can be in magazines. You cannot advertise cigarettes in magazines that appeal to children that are underage and could not buy cigarettes. The other is an effort on the part of the tobacco companies to move into Hollywood. And many years ago, if you remember the years of the movies where everybody in the movie smoked, and then there were years where no one smoked. And now, if you notice, some of, occasionally there's a very big-time named star, and in the movie they will smoke. And that was occurring in the 2000 series. And so there are different ways of doing that. On the illegal side, there is some discussion about Russia's ability to buy cigarettes in bulk, because through the internet, many of the cigarettes that are received in the country are coming through Russia. So those are just a few things that are impacting some of the things with the revenue.
And I think that the again the Department of Justice is very concerned about all of those issues, because they do involve consumer protection generally, and they take serious those responsibilities. So when they're here, I think, you know, you might get a better discussion about some of the efforts that are going on that are not just related to forcing compliance, but aimed at reducing cigarette consumption. The other thing that I want to mention here is the results of the fifth special session was, in fact, to set up a situation where there would be a dedication or a pledging or actually a sale of the rights to some of this revenue stream to a separate corporation. The head of the Department of Administrative Services and the treasurer were directed essentially to set up a separate corporation called the Master Settlement Corporation. The purpose of that corporation is to sell bonds, and the charge is to put $150 million into the state school fund by May 1st of this year. So they're in the process right now of trying to set up this corporation, determine what portion of this payment stream to sell to that corporation, and so they'll be determining what's left essentially of that payment stream for the legislature to use as an appropriation. So what I have here are, you know, hypothetical to a certain extent, or based on what I assume they're going to do given the legislative direction that was given to the treasurer at the time. And that legislative direction was to set it up to pay those bonds off as quickly as possible. And if they do that, they're going to essentially, they need to save $15.8 million a year, a biennium. I'm not sure. A year, $15.8 million a year, for debt service on $200 million in general obligation bonds, which were issued by Oregon Health Science University. Other than that, there is no other dedication as such, and so I'm assuming that Master Settlement Corporation will, in fact, use the rest of the money. And following the example that they set up, basically an average of $54 million a year during the first 3 years would be required to pay off those bonds, and that leaves basically nothing for legislative appropriation. In the fourth year, they actually pay those bonds off, so while a corporation gets $54 million, it returns $43.3 to the state as a residual, and that's available. So in that last year, that 06, 05, 07 biennium, you'd get $44.3 million. That's done, if nothing else is, if it's not changed by this legislature, and you return to where there's the only dedication is the Oregon Health Sciences University, and that carries you out through 2022-23, where that is paid off, and from then on, essentially, none of the revenues would be dedicated at this point.
Question.
Yes.
Did you say the $338 million is already spent for the coming biennium?
That's to be received by 6/30/2003, which is the end of this current biennium.
So not spent, but appropriated.
It's appropriated. Yeah. You know, I have no idea how much of it's been spent, and it, you know, it's all fungible, so it's not identifiable anymore.
Okay.
But I guess what I'm saying is there is no ending balance in some sense, which will carry over into this by any. Moving on to alcoholic beverages then, basically we have three types of excise taxes. On malt beverages, which includes beer and cider, on wine, which includes table wine and dessert wine, and then on distilled spirits, which are essentially distributed through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. These two being distributed privately. All of these products go out, are sort of commingled in their distribution. So up front, I put in the distribution formula. The privilege taxes, which are the taxes on beer and wine, of the wine portion, 2% comes off the top. It goes to the wine board. The balance then, which includes the rest of the wine tax, plus the beer tax, 50% goes to mental health, and then 50% is included in the distribution of net earnings from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission from the distilled spirits. And the way those are distributed, so you combine OLC revenue plus 50% of the privilege tax, and 56% of that goes to the state general fund, 10% to the counties by population, 20% to the cities by population, and then 14% to the cities by formula, which sort of rewards individual cities for their tax effort. The higher is sort of the local tax burden on the citizens of the city, the more revenue they get out of that formula. The history of the beer tax, going back to 1933, it was $1 per barrel. A barrel was 31 gallons. That increased then in 1935 to $1.30, I think it is, $1.30. In 1975 to $1.95, and in 1960 to $2.60, where it has been since. And that's equivalent to, it's not exactly even, but about 8.38 cents per gallon. You divide $2.60 by 31 gallons, you get about 8 cents a gallon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you break that, 8.38 cents per gallon down into people typically don't buy a beer by the gallon. I mean,
pints.
12-ounce can.
Yeah.
Okay. You've got, 128? So you got about 10. Just let's say 10. You got slightly over 10 cans to a gallon. So it's, 8-tenths of a cent per can, per 12-ounce can.
8-tenths of a cent. So less than a penny a can.
Less than a penny.
Right. Same would be true for bottles.
Mm. Yes. However you get your 12-ounces.
Same would be true for those big glasses at McMinnville's.
Again, if you look at the... compare Oregon as of actually this now is January 1 of 2002. Oregon is number 42 among the states. You can see that there is quite a bit of variation, Hawaii being the top of the list there. Again, in the tax, in the Oregon public finance document, the numbers are there for these distributions.
Can I ask you again about that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
That's all right. Is that state rate dollars per gallon both on beer and wine? That
no.
Number 42 ranking, or is that solely on beer tax?
That's beer. Okay. Malt beverage, they call it, includes beer and cider. Last year, the tax on beer generated $6.4 million, and again, following the formula, 50% went to mental health, 28% to the general fund, 5% to the counties, and 17% to the city. The history of the tax is fairly stable, as you can see over this time, raising, from 5 to a little over $6 million throughout this period. The distribution has remained constant over that period.
Representative Berger has a question.
I want to know about the 50% that goes to mental health. Is that designated in any way, or do you know how that is... Does it just flow to mental health?
Well, it's other funds revenue, and therefore ways and means, and essentially determines how they're going to spend that.
Okay.
So I don't know anything about it.
Thank you.
Now, dealing with the wine tax, as I said, we have table wine, which is less than 14% or less than 28 proof, and wine, which is over 14%, and table wine dominates the market, mostly vermouth type products that are in the dessert wine category. Dessert wine is moved into the private sector, back to OLCC in terms of public distribution, back into the private sector, and so on. So some years I don't have a tax rate, and that's because it's distributed through OLCC. So the tax rate started out at about 25 cents, jump up to 30, and at that time both the dessert and table wine were taxed at the same rate. Then dessert wine went back under OLCC, and the tax rate went down to about 23 cents for table wine. And then in 74, you have table wine staying at the same rate, but dessert wine privatized and taxed at 50 cents per gallon. 75 is the major increase here in at least dessert wine went up to about 75 cents. Table wine was increased to 35. And then 1977, remember that was the last increase in the beer tax. This was the major increase in the wine tax. And so you have table wine at 65 cents, dessert wine at 75 cents. And the only change after that was to fund the wine board, in which case 2 cents was added to each of those. So you're currently at 67 and 77 cents. Again, looking at just the tax rate itself, Oregon is about 23rd on table wine. Again, you see some blanks down here at the end. These are where the table wine is distributed through state stores, so I can't really compare them with Oregon. But for the ones that I compare, and table wine was the easiest. It's hard, really a mess on these ones to try and get comparisons. So I just compared the table wine. And Oregon does come out 23rd at 67 cents relative to other states. Now, sales tax is important in wine. And I assumed $30, I think, a gallon as a price for wine, which is about $6 a bottle. So if anything, that's a little bit low. And so it makes a lot of difference if you add sales tax on top of those rates. The result here, again, you find some states there are three of them. Pennsylvania, Utah, and Wyoming, where I don't have an excise tax at all, but just the sales tax is higher than Oregon's excise tax. Okay. So anyway, Oregon falls to about 45th. Again...
Oh, Dick, did you go back?
Yeah.
Where's California? On that graph, do you have a chart, you know? Sorry.
No, that's fine.
And if you've got it, while you're out of Washington.
California is 31st at 20 cents, or at $1.725, including sales tax. So it's right in here somewhere.
Can't see your finger, but that's
right in here somewhere. Wherever 175 is in
here. It's in the screen.
It's in the screen, right.
Okay.
Washington should be higher because it has a higher sales tax. I'm not seeing it for some reason.
$1.72?
Yeah, Washington is at $1.95.
Okay, Paul's got this. We're looking at California, $1.72 per gallon, including sales tax.
For table wine. Mm-hmm.
For table wine. And Washington, again, Dick, is what?
The wine tax and the beer tax produce about the same revenue. We had 6.4, I think it was, million from the beer tax.
Yes. Thank you. Before we get past the graph we were just looking at, I'm wondering if at some point we could have the major producing states pulled out of this so we could compare them with Oregon.
Oregon, Washington, California. The major wine-producing states?
Yeah, I guess I don't know offhand what they are, but I could certainly find out and do that.
Yeah. I mean, part of the issue around this thing is Oregon as a producer.
Oregon's a producer, but so is Washington and California, the two neighbors.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. And
the
other major one is New York.
A lot of
states. I don't know if they make wine out of corn or not. Anyway, revenues last year, $6.1 million. Again, 3% off the top to the wine board, and then slightly less than 50%, because that comes off the top, going into mental health, 27% to the general fund, 5% to the counties, and 16% to the city. And as I said, table wine dominates. Again, this is a interesting kind of but strange history. You do find a little increase in here, which is the tax rate increase, the 2 cents that went to the wine board, essentially. And then a period of decline, which probably has something to do with tastes and advertising with respect to whether it's good for your health or not. And then more recently, you find some fairly significant and stable growth. And I think this has sort of come about with the increase in the importance of wine in the Oregon economy. Yeah. And so that, well, tastes generally and nationally probably have just brought about an increase in wine consumption. Liquor markup, the way OLCC works essentially is that they purchase from a manufacturer, could be anywhere in the world, but then they add to that what they pay the manufacturer, or the manufacturer actually adds the federal tax on the product, and they add to that the transportation costs to get it to the OLCC warehouse. That becomes the basis. And then they apply a markup rate to that. And that base times the markup rate is the price you'll see in the OLCC store, agent stores for that product. Okay. And we start out here at about 85 or 84%, I think it is. And during the early 80s, there was a markup, an increase in the markup, which was intended to raise revenue during the revenue shortfall that occurred in the early 80s, and then the markup kind of returned, and then throughout these years, and I'm not quite sure, we do have an increase up to about 104%. Again, tight budgets, basically, with the increased state responsibility for school funding, and then this leveled off at about 104%, and it's dropped in the last couple of years because OLCC has adopted a new rule for pricing, which essentially divides the product into a high-end and a low-end value product and applies pricing formulas within both of those areas. And so the decline here to about 101%, I'm not sure whether that's just the result of the formula or whether it's some intention to reduce the markup. But anyway, that's where the markup has been.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Explain to me, is this done every session, this markup set by this committee, or is the OLCC body set this? How does this?
I think it's set by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure that Department of Administrative Services has a lot of impact on how they set that, and the governor's office as well. There has been no direct legislative input into the setting of these rates.
Thank you.
I say direct. If you look at OLCC sales over time, again, the green line is population, and the red line is cases sold. Now, this is a little bit of a hard to get at volume. I'd like to have volume in some meaningful sense sold. But cases is as close as I can get. And that's kind of declined, so that you find, if anything, during this period certainly, a decline in per capita consumption of the product. Find some recent growth. But if you look at, again, the value of the sales, you find that they're more constant and, in fact, recently growing with respect to Oregon's population. And that's primarily because of the change in the markup, but also the change in the product price that OLCC has to pay the manufacturer. Taking total revenue from Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which does now include the privilege taxes as well as what they earn from distilled spirits, they had $271 million essentially in gross revenue. And how that spent essentially is 47% of it went to buy the product. So that goes for the manufacturer's price, federal tax, and shipping. And then you get into operating expenses for all of the various activities that OLCC is involved in, as well as distributing the product to the stores and so on. Their expense of about 14% left over from the liquor sales, then essentially 33%, and then 1% from licensing fees and 5% from the privilege taxes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you explain privilege tax, please?
That's the beer and wine.
It's the beer and wine.
See, they're distributed separately, private, through the private market, and there's a tax actually applied against them, where distilled spirits are distributed by the OLCC, and the revenue comes from a profit or a net revenue resulting from that activity. It's not a tax, despite that it's included in excise. Again,
yes.
To follow on that question, is this privilege tax then? Is this funds from the sale of those other products through OLCC stores, or is the OLCC collecting the other taxes you've already described from everybody, or how? Where does that come from?
Basically, the tax on beer and wine is imposed at the wholesale level. So either the producer or the wholesaler, the first person who's essentially bringing it into the state, is paying a tax per gallon or per barrel for beer, and that payment is to OLCC. They're the tax collecting agents.
They're our collector.
Yes.
So this 5% you're talking about is all of that money.
Yes.
Thank you.
And if you take these three together, the 33%, 1%, and 5%, you got about $104 million. And where that went, 53%, well, let's start with zero up here, which is the wine board. It's really 0.2%, okay, went to the wine board. And then mental health, 6% of the total revenue into mental health, and 53% going into the general fund, 9% into the county, and 32% to the city. And if you look at the history of OLCC distributions, again, not as stable as the privilege taxes themselves, but you see some recent growth at least. I think some of these shifts, like between these 2 years, are movements of money, are not economic, but they're movements of money into and out of reserve funds at OLCC. When they build a new warehouse or remodel the existing facilities, they put money ahead of time into a reserve so that they can do that. And then if there's excess money, it comes out in the distribution the next year.
Yeah. There's individual.
I'm not sure. I want to go back to this chart on revenue on OLCC. I'm not really sure that I clearly understand. Where is it in the 14%? That goes to those people that are running the store?
Yes. Retailer compensation is an OLCC expense.
Okay. And does that encompass, does that take all the 14%, or is there something else in that pie?
All of the OLCC's warehousing activities, the distribution to the stores, those expenses are included in that 14%. To the extent that they have agents out in the field trying to make sure that stores are not selling to people under age 21, and also I think they actually get involved in checking cigarettes at the same time. To the extent that those agents are out there, that's part of their expense and is included in the 14%.
Thank you. Now tell me, which ones did you say are in the $104 million?
That's the net revenue from their operations plus licensing fees plus the privilege taxes. So it's the 33%, the 1%, and the 5%. If you add those up, you get 39%. 39% of their total activity of $271 million is your $104 million available for distribution.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Nick, just one more thing on that slide. So the... There's nothing there. I'm sorry. There is operating expenses. That also would include not just the that's their agency overhead as well. Then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I call that retailer compensation.
It is. It's more than just that. Yes. Okay. That's what I was looking for. And as you described it as retailer compensation, but it is more than that. Then, since it covers the other overhead for the agency.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Liquor stores do, of course, sell products other than liquor, and I'm assuming that that is outside of OLCC distribution and therefore outside of this graph. For instance, they sell pop and mixer and cigars.
I'm tempted to guess, but it's a logical conclusion and not something I know, so I probably better get back to you.
Okay.
I think the retailer compensation is based on the product sold. And that's what they get from OLCC. That's the distilled spirit.
The distilled spirit.
If they're buying other wine from OLCC, that would be included. But if they're buying cigarettes, they're buying it from somebody else, and whatever they make on that is
it's
not
a separate operation.
Separate, yeah. That's my guess, but I'm checking.
I would guess so too. Thank you. Representative Williams had a question as to the limitations on what they can sell. And it seems to me there are different licenses. I know in the sister store is basically a candy shop and gift shop and all. So I hear.
Yeah. I've never been in there.
And then you've got other, you know.
The one down by Magoo's, Mr. Chair, I think just about only sells liquor, as I recall.
I hear that, too.
Well, in Sun River, they sell groceries.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think there are different. I think the
that's
licenses,
definitely true. Yeah. And that was an issue with Sunday sales, which we dealt with in the third special session, or one of the first special session, I don't remember. But
neither do we.
In fact, Mr. Chair, the people at Sun River were quite happy with our Sunday sales law.
I was there shortly after.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the skiers on Sunday morning sometimes find that useful.
We're all revealing way too much here.
Yeah. Dick, if you take that $104 million that could be called revenue or derived from sale of liquor, excluding the 5% that's privileged, how does that compare, and maybe this is in the book, and I don't know how to derive it, to states that have a more traditional way of selling, and I don't know how many...
Non-controlled?
I guess my best answer to that is I don't know at this point.
Yeah, Washington, for instance, they don't control, do they, the way... Do they?
They do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
but California does not. Certainly.
But California is a country into itself. I'm looking for something more comparable to Oregon here in terms of population. And
what's Idaho doing?
Yeah, Idaho or something like that. I just would be curious how they tax and derive revenue if they're not selling the liquor themselves. I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Paul? Do you have... Okay, we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to it. I don't need an answer right now, but I'm just curious.
We have... the office has at various times tried to estimate what sort of a tax rate would be required to generate the same sort of revenue. And that turns out almost to be unworkable because the rate has to be so high. If you believe the elasticities that are involved, you know, you can't get a high enough rate to raise the same amount of revenue that we raised. But in any event, if you did, it would be a fairly high tax rate. But I've made no attempt to compare that with other states, and we can try to get some information.
One more follow-up. The other thing I'm curious about is how many states have this system?
Actually, quite a few.
And I'm sure Mr. Remain would...
I can get that number for
you. Could tell me.
You say you think 22?
20, I think.
20.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The liquor that's warehoused by the OLCC, I understand that isn't paid... But do they pay the manufacturers ahead for the warehouse liquor, or is that paid at the time of distribution to retail stores?
Um,
You're talking about what OLCC pays to the manufacturer?
Yes.
So well, I'm sure that's normal business operation. I don't know. I don't think that it's sent to them on consignment. So. I should have spent some time working for them. I'd be better at answering these questions. Okay. Back to the only thing I've dealt with here in the telecommunications area is the 911 emergency access fax. And that began in 1981 as 3% of the cost or the charge for access to the system. And that money was basically to develop the local response, which are called public purpose, public safety access points, PSAPs. And as we moved then throughout the 10 years up to 1991, we found, again, a need to centralize in some sense and develop a statewide network and at least reduce the number of response PSAPs within each county and consolidate those to the extent we could. And, again, increasing technology, the 3% was not enough, and there was a temporary increase in 1991 to 5%. And about that time, you had the boom in the growth and use of cell phones and a controversy as to whether or not cell phones were, in fact, subject to the tax. Some cell phone companies were paying a tax, some were not, and were planning essentially to sue. And the result in 1995 was a shift to a charge. Well, the reason cellular phones had a problem is they're basically billing per month. And that's not really an access charge. It's an access plus some number of minutes of long-distance telecommunication. So if they paid on their monthly bill, they'd be paying on a much higher base than the access charge for landlines. So there was a question of what if they were in fact eligible, what was the access charge for which they were eligible. In any event, the response was to change the nature of the tax from an access charge to a 75 cents per month per phone, essentially. So if you have two cell phones, you're paying $1.50 per month for the fact that you have two ways to access the 911 emergency system. Same is true if you have a landline. If you have a cell phone and a landline, you're paying 75 cents for each line. Revenue from this system, again, with the 3%, is fairly fairly flat, and some concern throughout this period as to how we actually count these things and who's actually paying the tax. Then a little bit of a jump as we move to 5%, and then some mixed relationships in here as we try to figure out what we're doing with cell phones. And then once the new 75-cent tax is imposed, we find a substantial and significant rate of growth in the revenues from this tax.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
75 cents per line. So if somebody has simply an internet line, they're paying 75 cents on that one also, even though there's no actual telephone attached to it.
If it has voice capability so that you could access the 911 emergency network. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
If it's totally a digital line, I think not.
Okay, thank you.
Totally a data line, I should say.
Thank you. Mr. Jay, another way of looking at this graph then, from the time that 75-cent charge was imposed, is that this also reflects an increase in the number of lines in use in the state.
Yeah, and you know, you've seen growth over time with population in landlines,
uh-huh.
But you've seen tremendous growth in the number of cell phones. Last area then is fuel taxes. And in the law, you have two separate taxes. One is called the motor vehicle fuel and aviation fuel tax, and the other is called the use fuel tax. And those definitions are not very useful ways of thinking about what these taxes are. Basically, the first tax here, which is the motor vehicle fuel tax, is on gasoline. But theoretically, it's on any fuel, the chief use of which is to propel a motor vehicle or an aircraft. And the tax is imposed on all the fuel, whether or not it's used for that purpose or not. And that's the basic difference in these two taxes. With the use fuel tax, which is diesel, compressed natural gas, propane, so on, the dominant use of those products is not to propel a motor vehicle. So you only tax those products when, in fact, the use is to propel a motor vehicle. So in the first case, everybody that buys gasoline pays the tax. And in the second case, only those people buying diesel fuel for use on the roads pay the tax. The gasoline tax is 24 cents if it's used in a motor vehicle, 9 cents for aviation fuel, and 1 cent for jet fuel. Now, if you buy gasoline, you put it in your lawnmower, it's not subject to the tax. And if you want to get your 20 cents back on that gallon, you can apply for a refund. There are more important refunds. Most of the important ones are like farm use, where you're burning a lot of gasoline in a tractor out in the field, not on the roads. That's eligible for a refund. You have a power takeoff on a truck with a separate tank, or you can identify the amount of fuel that you burned in that engine to run the power takeoff. Again, that's not used to propel the motor vehicle. It's eligible for a refund. Or in the case of diesel, you simply don't pay the tax to begin with.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't state here, but these numbers are per gallon.
Yes.
And about interestingly, my husband, who is a notorious tightwad, 2 days ago got wind of the fact that he's been spending 24 cents more than he needed to fill his lawnmower. How does he apply, Mr. Yates, for... Does he have to apply to the state of Oregon, or does he go to the retailer? I need to take this information home.
So we're after snuff and refunds.
I don't suppose anybody's done it. Never mind.
Not the retailer, certainly. It would be you'd have to apply to the Department of Transportation.
Thank you. I'll advise him. Enough.
They probably have a thing.
I'm sure they do. But I don't know who's in charge of that one.
Okay.
That's funny.
In the case of trucks, generally they pay, if they're gasoline-powered, they pay the gasoline tax. If they're diesel-powered, they pay the diesel tax. But if they're over 26,000 pounds in Oregon, they don't pay any fuel tax. They pay essentially an in-lieu tax, which is a weight mile tax. So instead of paying the fuel tax, they pay based on the number of miles they travel in Oregon. Then there are exceptions to that for certain types of trucks which pay an annual flat fee, log trucks, sand and gravel trucks, and chips primarily. And then there's one final exception, which is called the road use assessment fee, and that's for non-divisible loads over 98,000 pounds. So you've got the spruce goose or something that you want to move across Oregon. You can actually do that, but you pay under the road use assessment fee rather than under any of these other taxes. In Oregon, the gas tax and the diesel fuel tax are the same when they're used for a motor vehicle. Some states it varies. What I've tried to do is show primarily the history of the fuel tax, which increases from 7 cents essentially to 24 over this period from 1968. For comparison purposes, I threw in the dark blue bars here, which are the purchasing power of the current 24 cents in these different periods. Or the local tax, the tax during these periods, which would be equivalent to the purchasing power of 24 cents today. I think I said it right there.
So inflation adjusted.
Yeah, right. So you were better off in 1968 than you are today, essentially, in terms of purchasing power. But over that 14 years between 1968 and 1982, it's 14, I think it's 14, you lost a lot in terms of purchasing power. Granted, you have a one penny increase in the tax, but the rate would have to be up to about 12.5 cents to have the same purchasing power as you have today at 24. And then you find this series of 1 and 2 cent increases throughout that period, finally catching up essentially to the purchasing power of the current rate in 1990. And what the other thing that shows kind of is that the rate jumped to 24 cents in 1993, has not increased since, but the purchasing power of that rate has diminished over this period to 2003. Revenue from the fuel tax, two things drive this. One is VMT, well, three things really. Vehicle miles of travel, but also fuel efficiency, and the other thing is the tax rates. So you find all of these things combining to affect the growth in the fuel taxes. I think you find some fuel efficiencies here in the early 90s, and then SUVs essentially reversing that trend in terms of fuel efficiency. But you also find general traffic growth throughout the period. Weight mile taxes, all right. Basically, it depends on the weight of the truck. If it's between 26 and 80,000 pounds, it's subject to Table A tax rates. It doesn't matter how many axles the vehicle has or what it looks like. Weight determines the tax rate that it pays per mile. And this will increase from about 4 cents per mile for a 26,000-pound truck up to about 12 cents a mile for an 80,000-pound truck. As you move above 80,000 and between 80,000 and 105, the rates are graduated on weight. They continue to be increased with the weight of the vehicle, but they also depend on the number of axles. The more axles you have, the lower is the tax rate. And that's two ways to view that. A lot of people view that as a public policy of trying to encourage trucks to use more axles. I don't view it that way because I don't think it really offers that much of an encouragement. But I view it as being consistent with cost responsibility, and we'll get into that more later. But when you use more axles, you do less damage. You ought to pay less tax. Then, as I mentioned, some of the trucks that fall within these categories, if they're being used for specific purposes, can pay in-lieu fees, which are annual or quarterly payments based on the weight, again, of the vehicle. And there's three categories, log trucks, sand and gravel trucks, and wood chip trucks, essentially, that are eligible for these flat fees. And that will be, at least to make it as far as transportation, there is a bill to eliminate those fees, and if it gets through transportation, it will come to this committee. And the last is the road use assessment fee. This is what the rates look like for the 26 to 105.5 category. It doesn't matter how many axles. This suggests it's five, but up to 80,000 pounds, doesn't matter how many axles you pay this rate. Were you to move above 80,000 pounds with a five-axle vehicle, you would pay along this schedule. If you were to add another axle to that vehicle, you would essentially drop back down to this schedule and on down up to nine axles. So that's the encouragement, essentially, would be estimated reduction in the amount of damage that those vehicles do to the highways. The in-lieu flat fees essentially are $5.55 per hundredweight for log trucks, Farm trucks are $4.55, but we don't have any. Dump trucks at $5.55 per hundredweight, and chip trucks at $22.40 per hundredweight. An 80,000-pound truck. Now, most trucks you see on the road, 18-wheelers are described, most of them are running at 80,000 pounds. The reason for that, primarily, if you're seeing them on the freeway, is that that's the highest weight they can run at in California, and that's where most of them are coming from. So if they go through Oregon, they're at 80,000 pounds. If you compare these flat fees on an 80,000-pound vehicle, the log trucks here would be paying about $4,440 a year. So it's, you got 80,000 pounds, that's 800 hundredweights, and if you multiply that by $5.55, you've got $4,440 a year in flat fees. And those fees are supposed to, on average, for all trucks that are that elect to detach them from the flat fees, supposed to yield the same revenue as if they were under the weight mile tax. So it's not supposed to be a revenue advantage for them. The advantage is you have less paperwork. You pay the fee, you don't have to keep track of your miles. The road use assessment fee, and we'll talk more later about what an easel is. that's an equivalent single axle load. It's actually whatever the load of the axle is divided by 18,000 pounds raised to the 3.8 power for a single axle. You got different formulas for tandems and tritons. This can get to be kind of expensive, the road use assessment fee. Last night I tried to do an example with 132,000 pounds and stay with single axles. So what I get is six single axles at 20,000 pounds and a steering axle at 12,000 pounds. And that adds up to adds up to about 10 easels. So that you're paying about 50 cents a mile to move 132,000 pounds on the Oregon highways. This is the revenue from the weight mile tax. Again, basically influenced by VMT. If I had a little stronger growth in vehicle miles of travel for trucks than you do for automobiles, but basically comparable. It's influenced by growth in that, but also increased by the rates. And in general, cost responsibility, as a result of that, we try to have each class of vehicles pay in proportion to the amount of damage that they do to the road. So whenever the fuel tax is increased in general, the weight mile tax is also increased. So you find increases in the rates throughout this period. If you're wondering why the dip in the last period, that's because there was. The legislature actually reduced the weight mile taxes because of the result of the 99 highway cost allocation study showed the trucks were overpaying.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
A question regarding road use assessment fee. You use the Spruce Goose as an example. Other examples, would that be like a large turbine on an overweight?
Yes.
Overweight?
Yes.
Oversized load? How about mobile homes? Now, they are divisible. They usually go in two or three sections.
I don't think they're anywhere near the 105,500 limit.
Yeah. They are.
They're oversized, but not overweight.
They're not over 98,000 pounds.
Thank you.
I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Berger.
Could I take just a moment to inform the group about the Road User Fee Task Force? We will not have any legislation coming out of that task force, but I want you to be aware of it. It's a task force that is working on a different way of perhaps you're paying, those who use the roads would pay, and vehicle mile traveled is one that they're looking at seriously, and it's based primarily on the fact that either we may have gasoline revenue dropping or we may have less fuel in our country. So we're trying to look ahead and be visionary. two members of the House of Legislature at the legislature is on the committee, and two from the Senate, and there are other stakeholders that are involved in all the people in transportation. But it's a very creative, exciting conversation that takes place at this task force. The acronym is RUFF, R-U-F-F, Road User Fee Task Force, and for those of you who will be around for a while, a few years, you're going to see legislation come through as to perhaps changing the structure of how we pay for transportation and roads and bridges. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We've covered pretty much what happens on roads. I do have questions regarding rail, but you don't need to answer those right now as far as how rail is taxed. But my question for now is... transit districts, how do they fit into the tax system? Do they pay taxes just as a private party would?
Well, if it's a public transit district, such as the Salem Area Transit or TriMet or Lane County Transit, they're public entities. They're not paying tax. Mm-hmm. They are supported by taxes.
Yes.
In the case of TriMet and Lane, they're supported by both a payroll tax. So if you are in the district, the TriMet district, which is primarily Multnomah County, but I don't think it includes all of Multnomah County and may include some of the other surrounding counties. If you're in that district and you're an employer, you have to pay, and I forget the rate, but a rate against your full payroll.
Correct.
And there's also essentially an income tax on self-employment mm-hmm. in those two transit districts that are imposed and collected essentially city of Portland actually collects the I don't know who's collecting the self-employment tax, whether it's the Department of Revenue or whether it's but it's they're piggybacks
yeah.
with them.
I'm familiar with that. But so in effect, though, the use of the roads by transit districts is subsidized by the by private people. The wear and tear that they put on the roads.
Yes. If you know, if you're Greyhound, you're buying fuel, or if the bus is over 26,000 pounds, it is subject to weight mile tax.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a public agency, and the legislature has made these decisions along, school buses, for example, last session were exempted from the fuel tax. Basically, public agencies are not paying those taxes. They are exempt.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. We had a couple of questions, I think, hanging over from the discussion about OLCC and the control states. Paul Romain, do you want to come on up and just answer those briefly? I don't want to get into too long a conversation about that, but you had some information, I think, that was responsive to Representative Berger's or Representative Thompson's questions. I forget.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. You had some questions on distilled spirits distribution and beer and wine taxation and distribution, a few things like that I might be able to answer. There are currently about 18 and a half states that have a system just like Oregon. Half meaning Michigan, which is basically decided to go a little bit hybrid. What Michigan did is semi-privatized their wholesale end. What they did was they took the state warehouse out. They have four or five designated distributors around the state who get the product. It's still the state's product. They are just, in effect, distributing the product. And what they did when they implemented that system is they decreased the state take from the product. They lowered it. But there are 18 states, basically, that distribute distilled spirits the same as we do. It's really Washington State and Idaho being... our neighbors. California has their own free market, anything goes system. What happens on distilled spirits is the state really has the best of all worlds as far as purchasing. In the private sector, what we do is we have contracts with different breweries or wineries, and we purchase from them. We have to, depending on what brewery and winery and what your arrangement is, you either pay immediately, and then it's your cost to ship it, or you pay in a couple of days, because the brewery then takes it out of your account, and you pay for the shipping. You store it in your warehouse for whatever period of time, and then you distribute it. The state, being the sole purchaser of the product, does what's called bailment, and it's an absolutely wonderful system. It's what you can do if you are the sole purchaser. Basically, the state says to the manufacturer, we will buy your product, you will sell it to us at your lowest cost, you will ship it to us at your cost, you will store it in our warehouse in Milwaukee at your cost, and we won't pay for it until we take it out of the warehouse and put it in the retail shop. It is a huge cost savings. By way of example, the average wholesaler cost of doing business is about 20% of gross sales. The state cost of doing business, you saw their total amount was 14%. Their actual cost of doing business, which they are actually working on now because we've asked them to come up with a number, is somewhere below 10% probably. So it is an advantage to be the sole purchaser of a particular product, and it is marketed completely differently. Your state stores out there. There are a wide range of stores. Basically, you have the exclusive agencies like you have in Salem and most of the big metropolitan areas. In the smaller areas, you can't make it just selling alcohol, so they combine the sister stores. One, they try and limit the kinds of things that you, I mean, they're not going to give to a, you know, a children's toy shop a liquor concession. they do, like Sun River has mixed stores and things like that. There are 240 of those around the state, various places. The Liquor Control Commission, actually officially sets the price, but you actually have the greatest influence on the price of the product, because in the Ways and Means process, they say to the agency, we need X amount of dollars. What will you mark the price up to do that? And therefore, you will mark it up X amount. We usually say, even though the average price, you know, you look at about 100% markup, depending on if you start buying the premium brands and stuff, you're really looking at about, about 110, 100 to 114% markup. The price on distilled spirits is the second highest in the country. Fortunately for those who sell distilled spirits in this state, the highest is Washington State. So that does make a difference. Representative Barnhart had a question about producing states, and I would suggest that the producing states for wine, it's kind of funny. You go to these national meetings, and a lot of these states have their own homegrown wineries. Of course, they can't, and they all want to ship all over the country, but nobody's going to buy the Virginia wine or the Kansas wine or the Texas wine or whatever it is. But the four major wine-producing states are obviously California, New York, Washington State, and Oregon. And when you want to talk about, those of us on the West Coast believe the three quality-producing states happen to be located in the western part of the United States. They're all different kinds of wines and stuff. So when you compare producer tax rates, those are the good states to at least look at. As far as beer, it's fairly easy to look at the producer states. You have Miller, which is, their headquarters is Wisconsin. You have Anheuser-Busch, their headquarters is Missouri. And you have Colorado, and their headquarters for Coors is the headquarters there. Oregon produces the largest amount of micro beer in the country. And in a way, it's kind of unique. The Oregon share of market for micro beer, which Oregon produced micro beer, not the Red Hooks from Washington State, not the Fat Tire from Colorado or anything else. The Oregon-produced micro has 10% of the Oregon market. Now, that's an astronomical figure when you consider that the next highest state as far as percent of market is really Colorado. Their domestic micro production is 3%. Washington State's about 2% right in there. So it's a huge segment of the Oregon market. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I've been around booze for a long time, and
We're all reviewing.
Some may say too long, but.
All right. Thank you for answering those questions. With that, thank you, Dick, as well. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of the person who wanted to remain anonymous, I'd like to thank you and staff for making the print bigger.
Oh, yes. I wanted to mention that. I saw those on the desk. I want to thank staff for that as well, too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you've got the Reader's Digest enlarged version for sight impaired.
Mr. Chair, I did note that other than Representative Hass and myself, I think everyone else on this committee wears the spectacles. I don't know if you noticed that, Representative, but...
And you point the face.
No point. I just thought it was an interesting observation.
What?
Oh, the young. And, you know, it's really wasted on the young. You know?
The young and the restless as we come to the end of our time. So with that, I will thank you. Paul, tomorrow we have school funding. So we will be here 8:30 sharp. And thank you again. We're adjourned.